chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertrand
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
Hi, YouTube. This is our first live episode of Rom-Com Killjoys. Hi! And we are talking about, as we said, one of our favorite movies in honor of us being together in person for the first time in almost 2 years.
So long.
Since we started this podcast.
Yeah.
People, I don't know if they always know this, but I'm based in Texas. I record the show from Texas, and Eliza records it from here.
Yeah, we're in New York right now. We're in Queens. Janelle's visiting, finally.
Yes.
And we're going to talk tonight about Addams Family Values.
Addams Family Values, the year of our Lord, 1993. I'm realizing that I don't have a Google summary ready.
It's fine. What we're going to do instead is do the Eliza summary.
Oh, okay. All right. Listeners, I don't know if you're ready for this, but we are about to have the Eliza summary of Addams Family Values, the year of our Lord, 1993.
So Addams Family Values is a sequel to the Addams Family movie. And it is one of the rare cases of a sequel being better than the first one. That's just part of the summary, because it's true.
It's true.
It is about the Addams family being shaken up when a new member joins because baby Pubert is born. And his siblings, Wednesday and Pugsley, are unhappy with the new baby and attempt in many ways to get rid of it, prompting their parents to bring on a full-time nanny, played by the unbelievably amazing Joan Cusack.
Goddess, absolute goddess.
She enters the scene, and it immediately becomes clear that she is in fact trying to win over and marry Uncle Fester so that she can get all of his money and then kill him. The children pick up on this right away, and so she sends them off to summer camp so she can perform her dastardly deeds. While at summer camp, they destroy the summer camp and all rich white people.
All of them.
And in the end, the family teams up together to kill the evil bitch who tried to tear them apart.
That was an incredibly detailed summary, so I thank you. Like, I don't know if Google is listening to this episode or watching it live, but they should really hire you to write the summaries because they're most often quite terrible, and that was actually pretty
good. Yeah, that was detailed, obviously, and I feel like I gave away a little bit of what we're going to be talking about today, probably.
Probably, yes.
But I feel like I hit the important points.
You did, and I feel like also because you gave the Google summary this time, you get to ask the immortal question.
All right, well, we're going to raise our glasses, which have champagne in them. And I'm going to ask the newly minted Dr. Walker.
That's me.
What's this movie really about?
Well, as a newly minted PhD, my supposition is that Addams Family Values, 1993, is about alternative family structures and putting forward a more freeing, an alternative, a subversive, if you will, version of the American family, hence the title of the film, Addams Family Values, which for me has always been what's drawn me back to the film is that I think, well, the inversion of the classic American married couple, the husband who resents the wife, Gomez and Morticia are the inversion of that. And I love that. Who does not want a Gomez Addams, a Morticia Addams in their lives? And isn't that interesting? And so the rest of the film, I think, sort of subverts and inverts our expectations about what a good family is and what good behavior is all the way through.
Absolutely. I think the behavior part is a really big part of it because obviously Addams Family is based on a quite long history of this family franchise, as it were. The Addams Family started as a newspaper comic and then in the 1960s was turned into a TV sitcom. And then in the 90s was turned into Addams Family and Addams Family Values, the two movies. Since then, it has also had a spin-off musical. There was another animated movie recently. You know, it's a whole wide thing, but the whole sort of concept is that it's a family that exists in the macabre and exists sort of in this alternate world where they don't do all the things that we expect a normal nuclear family to do, but also still follows a lot of the functions of the sort of traditional storybook or comic book or sitcom nuclear family. Mm-hmm. And I think that that just gives any creator a really great platform with which to play around with what is sort of acceptable to society and
Yes.
what our expectations are for a family, because you take this sort of normal structure of like a family sitcom and then you just turn everything on its head. But then what do you discover about our expectations in doing that?
Yeah, and I think the primary one for me, like I said, is always the relationship between Gomez and Morticia. I mean, the Paso Doble dance that they do in that wild cave bistro
is so crazy.
It's crazy. It's totally iconic. And it's genuinely extremely romantic. Like, it sweeps me off my feet every time I see it. And that carries through the entire film. You know, the fact that Gomez and Morticia get carried away by their sexual desire for each other while she's giving birth to Pubert is just so, it's just chef's kiss, so beautiful. It is so not what we in American culture, really in any culture, expect mothers to do, is particularly
right.
during birth. And yet the film just says like, no, Morticia's still hot. She's
right.
unbothered.
Well, that scene I love because, you know, they're rushing her to the hospital. She's just announced that she's having a baby and is having it right now. So you've already got this sort of subversion where you don't have the traditional, like, you know, the traditional long wait of the birth and the buildup and the buildup and the buildup, especially if you're talking about a sitcom style, you normally sort of have someone be pregnant over the whole season, right?
Right.
And instead she's just like, I'm giving birth right now, here we go. And then they're rushing her to the hospital and he's saying, are you in agony? Are you in pain? And she says, yes, it's divine, or yes, it's wonderful, or something like that. And she just enjoys the process. And like, obviously birth is painful for many, many people. And it's not normally just like an easy thing. But the type of birth that we're used to seeing on screen is so specific, that kind of agonizing, endless screaming, the woman insulting the man, yelling, you did this to me.
Right.
You know, she only finds out she's going into labor because her water breaks. Like, it happens the same way every time. And so from the very first scene of this movie, we're instantly subverting your expectations for like, how this happens on screen.
Yeah,
regardless of how it happens in real life. And again, doing it in this way where they're really enjoying the pain and the sort of twistedness of it, but like, it's a happy moment, right? They're welcoming someone new into the family, and even the Adamses like turn this into a happy moment, which is great.
And it does, you know, the arrival of Pubert also offers other opportunities for them to sort of invert our expectations about babyhood too. Like, there's that great moment where they put Pubert in the bassinet, that like horrifying bassinet with the knives and the glass hanging over it, which is incredible. And then he's crying, and then they give him this horrifying teddy bear that calms him down. But there's also these other moments that I really picked up on this time that I hadn't noticed in other watchings of the film. The first one is that when Debbie first arrives for her interview with the nanny of the kids, she goes, oh, is this the little critter? And Morticia says, no, it's our baby, which is a great moment to like indict how we think about children sometimes.
Well, and especially in a family that like probably does have critters running around, like
yeah.
they draw the line there. They're like, no, this is a baby.
Yeah.
Like, that's a strange creature.
The critters are in the greenhouse. and then the other one is that after they have Fester's bachelor party, Pubert is like hungover and they give him like a hair of the dog cocktail in his bottle, which is so, I had not noticed that before. And it blew my mind when I saw
Well,
that.
And Gomez calls it hair of the pup too,
hair
which
of
is
the
so
pup.
Cute.
It's adorable. What?
The whole bachelorette party thing is also wild.
Right.
Because you get this like very traditional, like everyone's showing up for this party and it's mostly like family and family friends. And the men go off into one room where they're like, you know, smoking cigars and having a sort of, you know, bachelor night, and the women go off into another room that looks more like a sort of bridal shower. And it's following all of those traditional like tropes, but in the very Adamsy way.
Yes.
You know, like they accidentally cook the stripper into the cake.
Oh, so dark. I completely forgot about that. And then when I watched that moment, I just thought like, how did they get away with this movie being like, I think it's rated PG.
Yeah. I was reading an interview that had happened just a few years ago with a bunch of people involved in the movie. And I think it was the director, it was either the director or the writer, was saying that when they made it, because it was the Adamses and because it was supposed to be weird and strange, they actually got very little pushback on anything they wanted to do from the network, from the production company, which is strange. Like, a lot of times something like this, you'd constantly get execs coming down being like, oh, don't make that joke, oh, whatever. But he was like, yeah, no one had any problem with us dropping a baby off a roof, and we really thought they would, and we'd have to fight for it, and they just let us do it. And I think it sort of happened at just the right time, that sort of early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It was this weird kind of funky thing, and they just kind of let them get away with it. But that gives them the opportunity to make all these dark jokes and weird jokes. You know, at one point she's looking at Pugsley, who's like, whatever, 11, and she says, "Aren't you a little lady killer?" And Gomez goes, "Acquitted." And it's so dumb, but it's so funny because he's so joyous about it.
Mm-hmm.
That and these Gomez, these Adams men, where do you find them?
It has to be damp.
Why is that the best answer?
It's just because
of all time.
Every line reading Angelica Houston gives in this film is exquisite.
Exquisite.
I mean, just the whole speech of what Debbie, I could accept you stealing Fester from our family. I could accept you, whatever. Turning him into your sex slave. But Debbie, pastels?
It may be the greatest
It is probably the greatest line reading in cinema history, I think.
I've seen a mashup online of her going, pastels for spring, groundbreaking. And it has that same energy, right?
Absolutely.
That same Devil Wears Prada, Meryl energy. And the lighting on her face, which apparently started because Angelica Houston actually has a clause in her contract that she has to have an additional key light on her face in every scene. And for those who aren't, you know, movie tech sound, what that means is that there's normally something that's lighting the background, something that's filling the space, and often then an additional light that's on the actor's faces specifically. And those lights combine to create a very well-lit scene. If you were to just have one single light, even though that's how we normally exist in real life, on screen that looks very flat and strange. But she had found that she'd been in a lot of movies where she didn't like the lighting on her face. Mm. And she's a big enough star that she can put a clause in her contract that she has to be able to approve of lighting on her. And so she has an additional light that's specifically on her face at all times. And they gave her that, but they started playing with it. And they found that if they made the slot really thin, they could get it right across just her eyes. And it has this like ethereal, spooky thing. It kind of has a little bit of that sort of like film noir lighting through the blinds kind of feel.
Absolutely.
So she's got a femme fatale vibe going on, even though she's not the femme fatale of the movie. That's Joan Cusack as Debbie.
Funnily enough.
Right, but it's every line feels dramatic because suddenly the lighting changes when you jump to her. And it's so good and it sets the tone so well.
Especially those medium close-ups where it's like her face and body is the entire screen. It is those references to like the 30s and 40s cinema with the bar across the eyes. The filmmaking in this movie is actually like kind of extraordinary. But while we were talking about this, I realized we've gotten this far in the conversation without acknowledging that like this movie is not a rom-com exactly.
But it is, Janelle.
But it is.
Because here's the thing, guys. This movie has three main couples.
It does, that's true.
And I think we should break them down.
We've talked a lot about Morticia and Gomez, right, who are the obvious.
They're the established couple.
Yes.
As in any rom-com, often you have the friend who's already married.
They are the romantic standard.
But unlike the, sometimes you get the friend who's married and complains about their husband all the time, or sometimes you get the friend who's like happily married and the single friend is trying to be like them. Mm-hmm. Boom, that's what you've got. Then you have the, what appears to be the main couple of the movie, but in the end does not end up together. True. And turns out to be quite toxic in Fester and Debbie.
Toxic to say the least.
And then you have, I think, our most successful coupling.
Wednesday and why am I forgetting his name? Our young David Krumholtz. What's his name?
I just call him David Krumholtz.
Wednesday and David Krumholtz.
I'll Google it.
Thank you. Our tech support's gonna look it up for us. He's got like a nice Jewish boy name, doesn't he?
He does. Some kind of nice Jewish boy
Aaron,
name.
Aaron, Zachary.
Well, and you know, maybe we can start with Wednesday and David Krumholtz. because it reminds me that, you know, the Addams Family is based on, in some ways, they're based on the comics, right? Mm-hmm. Which were created by Charles Addams.
Yeah.
Joel.
Wednesday and Joel. Charles Addams, there's some like speculation and cultural criticism around the Addams Family that part of what he was expressing, at least in his own work, in the comics, was that the Addams Family were like a cipher for Jewishness in a sort of like a Gentile world, in a sort of Gentile WASP world.
Right. Sort of like they're at all times celebrating Hanukkah when everyone else is celebrating Christmas.
Exactly. And so in some ways, it's kind of interesting to see Joel show up as this character who's like quite obviously coded as Jewish, although I don't think they ever say that explicitly.
No, but he's pretty, I mean, to be fair, a lot of the people at the summer camp are coded as Jewish.
Yes.
But a lot of them are coded as sort of WASPy Jewish, if that makes sense. Either like they're a little bit of both, or they just have grown up in a very WASPy part of New England and so have taken on a lot of those sort of cultural touchstones, whereas he and his parents are coded as very stereotypically like New York Jewish, like Lower East Side, heavy New York accents, fussy, neurotic, and that's supposed to be in contrast to the like very sort of toned down, blonde, you know, sort of poised other kids at the camp. And so you get him as this like weird little kid in the corner, and then you get Wednesday and Pugsley, who feel much more comfortable with him than they do with anyone else at the camp, which if we're going with that kind of reading that the Adamses are this stand-in for a Jewish family, totally makes sense.
But it is sort of interesting because the camp does sort of come off as one of these like classic, like upstate New York, like Jewish camp, Jewish summer camps, you know, so it's kind of interesting how there's like mixed representations there. And very famously, there's that scene where Wednesday, they're telling ghost stories in the camp, and Wednesday's contribution to it is that you wake up and the ghost has given you back your old noses, which feels like, again, like a very sort of like...
Right, like these, even these Jewish blonde kids are definitely coded as Jewish.
Right.
But like a certain type of wealthy Jew.
Yes.
And then the David Krumholtz character is coded differently. So yeah, that's definitely interesting to think about. And there's a lot of like Jewish last names when they're doing the roll call at the camp. Like he's definitely not the only Jew at camp.
Definitely not.
But he is this like weird nerdy kid. And there's a whole sort of like squad of the weird nerds who don't fit in at camp. And like the only black kid at camp is among them. Mm-hmm. A kid in a wheelchair is among them. Like all of the things that would make you other at a camp like this, that is mostly white, mostly wealthy, mostly able-bodied, they all get lumped together. But then they all get their opportunity for their comeuppance.
Yes, they do. Well, I love that they all kind of as a group come to represent like an opposition to what we call in academia, because I have a PhD. I don't know why I did that. I'm so sorry.
I'm so glad you did. You should be bragging about that all the time. Guys, she's a doctor.
A doctor, what?
Dr. Walker.
Oh. Dr. Walker.
Oh, is that?
PhD.
That's me. They come to represent sort of the what we call the non-normative, right? Like the non-hegemonic like people in the situation. And that's why when they do take their revenge on the Thanksgiving pageant at camp, which they do in the summer? Question mark?
Your classic summer Thanksgiving pageant.
Sure. It has a particular heft to it, which is why I think it has remained this sort of like internet meme that people love to do. I mean, at Thanksgiving, how many times have we all seen that GIF of Wednesday lighting the match, right?
Right. Like, for those who haven't seen the movie, first of all, go watch it.
It's fantastic.
But they put on a summer theater production at the camp that is about the first Thanksgiving. And it really isn't. None of the details in there, even by our sort of, like, very watered down, polite version that we teach kids. Like, it's the wrong Native Americans at the tribe. They make up a bunch of names. Like, it's completely wrong. But theoretically, it's about the first Thanksgiving. And it's very clearly supposed to be all screwed up and wrong. The two camp counselors who have written it have made it very, like, and then the white people came in and they saved the Native Americans. And you're supposed to already be rolling your eyes.
Yeah.
But then Wednesday and Joel and all of their followers essentially stage a coup in the middle of the performance and burn everything down and tie up all the kids who are playing the pilgrim characters, and it ends with one of them like literally roasting on a spit. And it's clearly supposed to be this like joke about the natives rising up against the Europeans, but it also is these kids who are othered at the camp rising up against the norm at the camp. And it's chaotic and insane and wild. And Wednesday delivers this excellent speech about you coming in and giving us smallpox blankets and we won't stand for it anymore. And it's fantastic, but she's horrifying the parents in the audience, right? Like they're all like, oh no, you know, it's very CRT panic.
Definitely. It actually has a strong resonance with the current critical race theory.
It's kind of like, we're going to panic because they're teaching our kids this thing that I couldn't even define, and they're not teaching our kids and they probably should be anyway, but we'll just panic because it's something to panic about. Yeah. And like, that's absolutely what's happening here. And I think that the filmmakers knew what they were doing with this, right? Like they're taking the Addams Family. They named the movie Addams Family Values, right? And where this is 1993, so we're just coming off of the first Bush era. We're coming off of this, you know, sort of 80s Reagan era.
Yeah, the Reagan hangover
of
kind of.
Republican family values, middle America family values, right? And that so much of that is based in this American, you know, Christianity, evangelical, nationalist type of thing. And they claim that, like, we're the ones with family values, we're the ones with morals and ethics and blah, blah, blah. But then you can't be gay and you can't have abortion and you can't be anything other. And then you have the Adamses, who are othered in every way, but have a loving parent household, have multiple family members living in the house. In the end, the family comes together to work together to protect themselves. Like, the parents are supportive of their kids, even when they don't understand their kids' things, which is another sort of recurring theme. At one point, the baby starts behaving like a normal baby. Like, he sprouts blonde curls and he's gooing and guying and listening to baby music, and they're reading him baby stories, and it's treated as if he's sick. Like, they're like, oh, we don't understand why he would want to do this. And this is actually based on an Adams Family TV episode. There's an episode where they think that Pugsley is into, like, normal all American boy things, when it actually is a misunderstanding because of a friend he made at school. But they, like, buy him, like, a Boy Scout uniform and a baseball bat and all this kind of stuff. And it's treated as really weird, but the parents still do it. They're very supportive.
Yeah. And I try.
I love that messaging that, like, even if you don't understand it, it's important to your kids. And as long as it's not hurting them, like, we're going to be behind you 100%. And that's not really the, like, family values messaging that was happening in the early 90s, but it's what's happening in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's very sweet, this movie, in many ways. And even though Wednesday is sort of part of what makes the dynamic between her and Joel work is that she's such a kind of terror and he worships her anyway. So it's like they constantly make references to the fact that it's almost a reiteration of Morticia and Gomez's relationship, but not exactly. And that's kind of fun. But I think that that's kind of related to how, you know, the parents just, they accept that Wednesday and Pugsley are trying to kill the baby. They don't love it. They get a nanny to try and, like, supervise, and they don't kill the baby. But it's just delightful that they're like, you kids, setting up a guillotine in the attic again. That is, I think, one of my favorite sequences, actually. Woe to the Republic.
It's the baby dressed in the Marie Antoinette outfit that really just gets me.
It is just magnificent. Yeah, and I also love the moment where they get to the camp, speaking of, you know, like, encouraging your kids, when I believe that character's name is Sarah Miller.
Sarah Miller, yeah.
She, her parents show up and they're like, oh, you know, she's like the queen of camp and she gets straight A's. We should love her at school. You know, what about your boy? And Gomez puts his arm around Pugsley and says, probation. Big smile on his face. It's just wonderful. It's just delightful.
Well, and right after that, they say that Wednesday's at that phase where a girl only has one thing on her mind. And they're like, boys. What is it she says? She says
homicide.
So they're very supportive, and we love that. We love a supportive family. We love supportive parents. Mm-hmm. And the Joel and Wednesday relationship, I really like, because it's very sweet and it's very innocent. They're teenagers, but they're young teenagers. They're supposed to be like 13, 14. And it doesn't go beyond that, right? It's not like sexualized in an unnecessary way or even just sort of adultified. Like, it's very much kids who are having their first crush and their first kiss and their first whatever, but still within the language of the Adamses.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I think the best encapsulation of that is that in the end of the movie, they get a nice little kiss when she runs away from camp, but in the end of the movie, he's putting on his little Gomez costume and he's trying so hard to, like, win her over and for them to have their, like, wrapped up little relationship moment at the end of the film. And instead of it being that, it's Joel saying, you know, what if, well, would you want to get married and have kids? Wednesday says, no. She says, well, but what if it was a man who would worship you, who spent his entire life trying to make you happy, who would do anything, who would die for you? What does Wednesday say?
I would pity him.
I mean, it's just, it's so great because it is both, like, innocent childhood. It's kind of avoiding all of the pitfalls that you're talking about, but it also allows Wednesday to be, like, a different little girl, right? Like, a subversive girl who's like, no, I don't want those things. No, I want to think about murder. Debbie was sloppy. If I tried to kill my husband, I'd scare him to death. I mean, it's fabulous the way that it works. Very subversive.
She's such a character who's so confident in who she is at all times. Everything she does in this movie is with complete confidence and poise.
Totally.
And again, she's a 13-year-old girl, right? This is right at the age that a lot of girls start to really doubt themselves and have body image issues and self-image issues, and they don't give her that, right? Like, part of what is subversive about her is just that she is confident and knows who she is and is strong-willed, and like that, to show that in a 13-year-old girl in a positive light is so different. It really says a lot about our sort of normal depictions.
Absolutely, it does. No question.
And it's really kind of great. And then again, he's, you know, he's got all the sort of stereotypical goofy nerd, neurotic, you know, kid things, but he also is very enamored with her and is very willing to go along with her plans and all of her weirdness, and he really respects her. And again, I don't think you see a lot of teenage boys who are depicted with that kind of respect for their first crush in that way.
True. He basically worships her. I mean, yeah. He does. Like, that's kind of the
whole thing. Yeah.
And that is a kind of configuration we don't usually see with kind of teenage pairings, not like full out worship.
Right.
You know, at worst, maybe mutual worship. Mm-hmm. But I feel like this is, and speaking of worship, we got to talk about Debbie and Fester. Can I tell you that I find something new to appreciate about Joan Cusack's performance in this movie every time I watch it.
I mean, she's flawless.
She is flawless. What really got me this time was how the entire exposition for her character happens in one scene, and it's from an America's Most Wanted send-up, right, of her, like, background as a Black Widow, you know, con artist. And in any other movie, with any other actor, that would annoy the shit out of me. I'd be like, that is the laziest fucking exposition I've ever seen. You're going to have someone read the exposition on a TV show?
But conveniently, it works somehow.
Why would she be watching it? Why would she happen to watch the episode that she was on in 1993? She didn't know that that was what the episode was going to be about. You can't fool me. I know things. And instead, all you're focused on is Joan Cusack giving you an entire melodrama on her face while she watches it. You know, they say, well, these are the three women. They're all three different women. And she's eating her chocolates and going, yes. No. Ooh. How about it? Yeah. Yes. Yes. And she's enjoying it. I mean, she's just giving you full... If you're just listening to the audio of this episode, it's not going to translate what I'm doing with my face. But she is giving you full soap opera face.
She fully is. It also, I think, just tonally works because she's in the Adams' house when she's watching this, and it's on sort of like a crinkly kind of old TV set, and there's thunder and lightning happening outside, and it feels like it's very obviously expository, but it feels sort of like an old, like, 70s B movie kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the killer is on the loose, and we don't know where they've gone, but they're somewhere near the, you know, the old prison, and then, like, lightning flashes, and then the kids realize they're in trouble. Like, it has that kind of vibe tonally, which I think, because this movie is so sort of exaggerated and cartoony, works in that moment.
Absolutely.
And yeah, and then she's just hamming it up. I mean, in every scene, she's just having a ball. Like, and interestingly, so she comes in and she's always in a very sort of like white Marilyn Monroe kind of dress, low cut. She's got bleach blonde hair. Her makeup is always flawless. She talks in this very feminine voice. And I honestly, like, she's sort of coded in a lot of the ways that the obnoxious blonde girls at camp are coded. Like,
oh, there's a good parallel.
She's
there.
Sort of the adult definitely version of them. And in fact, when she's giving them her, like, how I became this way story, which is amazing, and is doing a slideshow of old pictures of her, there's a picture of her as a little girl, like, throwing a tantrum, and she looks very similar to Harmony, to I can't think of her actual name, the actress.
I don't know.
McNabb. It's something McNabb. Whatever, who plays the
Harmony
girl at camp. She then becomes Harmony and Buffy, which is what that moment was in my head. But the way that she looks and is dressed and has her hair done, whatever, is very similar to the way that the...
Mercedes McNabb,
there you go.
Tech support.
Is very similar to the way that young Debbie is portrayed, and you can totally believe that she came from a similar family. She's clearly upper middle class. She's in a big house. Her parents have bought her all these toys, but the wrong toys. Malibu Barbie. I was a ballerina. Delicate. I think her delivery of the word delicate may be the best delivery in the entire movie. And like, this is a movie of flawless deliveries the entire time.
Yeah.
I mean, because you've got, you know, Angelica Houston, and you've got, I mean, it's, but delicate, like, just that one word, Oscar winning performance.
Yeah, I mean, we just have to take a little divot here because we are going to go back to Debbie and Fester, but we just need to stop and think about who is in this movie. because it's another one of these rom-coms. Sometimes we stumble upon a rom-com and I just, or I mean, I guess this is not a rom-com, but it's a movie.
But it is.
It's a rom-com, I guess. The cast is bonkers.
Yeah.
Angelica Houston. Raul Julia in one of the last movies he ever made before he died, right? We have Christina Ricci.
I mean, who was so flawless in the first one that they expanded her part tenfold for the second movie.
Mm-hmm. And Christopher Lloyd, David Krumholtz. We have Christine Baranski as an unhinged camp counselor.
She's so funny.
She's so funny.
And then you also have these weird cameo bits. Nathan Lane is in it for like 90 seconds.
Who does he play?
He's the cop when they go to, they go because they think that Fester's been kidnapped by Debbie and they go to the cops to report it. But they're basically like, yeah, my brother's living with his wife now. Go arrest her. And so the cop is like, okay, dude, get out of my face. It's Nathan Lane.
I did not realize that at all.
It is. And then Tony Shalhoub.
Right, Tony Shalhoub, I do remember.
1 30-second. Debbie goes to the bar and is drinking with a bunch of sailors because they were like, this will be aesthetic.
Macho, macho man.
And Tony Shalhoub is hitting on her. And then she leaves. And like, he wasn't like totally like Tony Shalhoub at this point. He wasn't super famous. But I feel like he was big enough that it's like weird.
It's definitely a cameo of some kind. Yeah.
So it's a wild movie. And the performances are so great. And I think all of them just like, it's such a great script to sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
And really play up. And you get so few opportunities as an actor to really have like a rich part like that. That's so funny, but also dramatic. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, like there's real drama that happens here. There are multiple murder attempts.
Yeah. And successful electrocution. So.
Yeah. And they're just there all having a really great time. And Joan Cusack, like she was so made for this role.
Yeah, and you know, her dynamic with Christopher Lloyd as Fester is so perfect because they're both doing big, huge choices.
Yeah.
But because the tone of them are so different, it really works. Like Christopher Lloyd is playing a like really low tone in his voice. He's really doing something that is so like manic, and she's playing this like blue flame femme fatale who flies off the handle every once in a while. It's just the balance of it is really good.
Well, and his character is so childlike in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And it's set up in the first movie, the plot is that Fester has essentially had his memory erased and someone has convinced him that he's someone else and they come in to try to win the Addams family money. But then it turns out he's actually their Uncle Fester and he gets his memory back. But so the setup for that is like he's sort of seen as very childlike within the family because he's just rejoined the family and he's the little brother and he's, you know, had these difficulties in the past. And so Gomez treats him very sort of paternalistically and not necessarily in a bad way, but just like, even though he's clearly an adult and he's played by someone who's not even a young adult, he's treated like he's quite young and quite new to the world and innocent. And then she comes along and is so knowledgeable and world weary and sexy. And, you know, and she plays up this whole, like, you know, I've never even had sex thing. I'm a virgin. And she's trying to like play it up so that he'll be like, oh yeah, I'm going to get myself a virgin, which is what she's expecting. And instead he's like, me too. That's so great. And so then she has to totally change how she's playing the game. And so for him to be this very like childlike character, she pulls the thing that in real life and on screen works the most to sort of confuse children, which is to wildly oscillate between emotions.
Yes.
And it makes sense to your brain that that would frighten him into submission because you're seeing him as very childlike, even though he's being played by a very adult Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah, and you're right. That kind of, the tension between those two things is so successful. It's so compelling. Like the scene where they get to Hawaii and it's their honeymoon and she tries to murder him the first time by throwing a jukebox, like a boombox, into the bathtub with him. And he just
classic.
Is like, he just comes out smiling like, hey. They get into bed together and, you know, big night, they're going to have sex for the first time. My favorite line that she says is, well, if you've never had sex, how do you know we're not having it right now?
She delivers it so catty too. Like just, it's so bitchy.
It's incredibly bitchy. And then his reaction to it is so subtle where he just like, for a minute he's considering it. And then he just is like, no, that's silly. Yeah. I wouldn't consider that. And it's just such a, oh, it's almost a throwaway line, but that moment kind of encapsulates their dynamics so perfectly.
Yeah. And then she sort of treats him as a Ken doll once she realizes, you know, that they're going to be stuck living together for a while. Mm-hmm. And she gets him, you know, fake hair and a new clothes, and she's creating their sort of model house. And again, it's this whole sort of like playing at our expectations of a normal family, yes, or of success, yes, or of, you know, what is socially acceptable, right? Like, she's gotten this huge big mansion and she's made her husband look a little more, you know, sophisticated theoretically. I mean, he still looks ridiculous because it's Fester. But they're moving in all this furniture and she's yelling at the moving guys and she's like, these are expensive, beautiful things. They're from catalogs. And, you know, and she's creating this catalog life, right? Which is what we're supposed to think everyone wants. And she's the one who's a mass murdering nutcase, right? Like, these people who live in this insane old creepy house are the ones who have a very happy family dynamic. Mm-hmm. And she's, you know, creating what we expect to see from success and perfection and the norm. And it's,
yeah,
hiding the truth.
You know, and you say that makes me think about, so if we accept your proposition that the Addams Family Values specifically is a romantic comedy and is our like overarching mission for this podcast, is that there's something that we can learn about, mm-hmm, our culture and our attitudes about romance and dating and sexuality from these movies. What is it that Addams Family Values is trying to tell us then about, mm-hmm, relationships, do you think?
I mean, I definitely think it's trying to tell us to look more than skin deep, mm-hmm, like just on a very basic level. And that's not to say, like, I mean, everyone in this movie is beautiful, but just sort of don't just look for the normative image, mm-hmm, you know, and the normative image of what a couple is.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real message about the value in actually talking to each other and respecting each other. Again, the, you know, the men who are in good relationships super drink their respect women juice in this movie.
Oh yeah.
This movie might have invented respect women juice.
I didn't know respect women juice was a thing, but I'd like to buy a crate.
Yeah. I mean, Gomez makes it in his house in the basement.
Wow, it's really delicious. It's probably like red wine and clove.
Yeah. You know,
it's like a very fall vibes. It's just mold wine is what respect.
But it's like very French mold wine.
Yeah, it's like extremely French. It has brandy in it. It's like the fancy kind of mold wine, not the shitty kind you made in college when you were broke out of the red wine you forgot you had.
That's what respect women juice is.
Straight women aren't allowed to talk about this anymore.
What? Our live studio audience is really like taking us to task right now. I don't know how to feel about that.
I feel like I just want to keep thinking about Gomez Adams and how amazing he is.
He, the number of times that I have encountered men either through dates or through dating apps who have said that they are a Gomez type. It's a high bar, gentlemen. I'm just going to say it.
You know what? If you are a Gomez type, you're going to show me, not tell me. Because that man is all about showing his love and his respect for his wife.
Because the thing about being a Gomez type, I feel like, is what people think that means is that, like, oh, like, I'm obsessed with my partner in a sexual, mm-hmm, way. It's like, no. That's not it. Gomez is not obsessed with Morticia in a sexual way. Gomez is like Don Quixote come to the modern era. He would fight a windmill for that woman, yes, and she wouldn't need to ask. She wouldn't even, right, need to be threatened by the windmill. He would just look at that windmill and think, I need to be impressive to Morticia Adams, and I'm going to fight that goddamn windmill if it will impress her.
Right, like, I feel like people think Gomez Adams is like the Will Smith meme of him being like, my wife! And like, that's great, but that's not what Gomez is doing. He's not walking into a room and being like, everyone, look at how great Morticia is. He's taking Morticia for a walk right after she's had a baby to ask her how she's feeling. And then when she says that she's feeling overwhelmed and doesn't have enough time to summon the dark forces, he's like, then let's get a nanny. You know, he's like finding out his kids want to go to a summer camp that he doesn't understand, and he takes them to summer camp. He's checking in on his brother and making sure he's okay and happy in his new marriage. And when his brother starts acting differently, he instantly picks up on it. And he's like, something's wrong. This is what a Gomez Adams is.
Gomez Adams is emotional intelligence. Yeah. That's what it is. It's emotional intelligence. It's listening. And yes, also being a sexual dynamo.
Like, yeah, and like being able to pass a doble like nobody's business.
You got to do both. You know what I mean? You know? Like, I don't want, like, miss me with your gym trying to find your Pam? No. And not even really like your Gomez trying to find your Morticia, because no, that's not a thing. Morticia's too high of a bar for any living human being. So
yeah, we're not Morticias, so.
No. So instead, just, you know, live your life like Gomez Adams does.
I think you just should be someone who's trying to find your Adams family.
See, that's actually what I think the takeaway is for me that I really love, like, in a serious way about, mm-hmm, this movie, is that it has always reassured me that, like, yeah, you know, we're told all the time, and even in, like, really subtle ways that we don't always feel conscious of, that we need to be having relationships in the right mm-hmm. way. We need to be having friendships in the right way. We need to be making sure our family relationships are the right relationships, right? But this movie kind of allows space for, no, you know, relationships look different between right. different people. And if they work, they work. And if everyone's happy, mm-hmm. that's great. If Wednesday and Pugsley try to kill each other all the time, it doesn't mean that they don't love each other.
Right.
They do. That's the version of their relationship that works.
Well, and everyone in this, all of the sort of the leads, all have a very strong community.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we see these scenes of the bachelor party and the birthday party at the end, and they've got a lot of family there, but there's also friends there, and they're all sort of different shapes and sizes. And, you know, they've got Cousin It, who's there with his new wife, who's one who's, like, from outside of the family, right? Mm-hmm. She's sort of the normal person who steps in and becomes part of the family.
She's, like, good Debbie.
Right. She's exactly. She's the good version of Debbie, mm-hmm. who, like, seems like a normal, you know, normal world person, but who somehow fits into the family, and they love talking to her mm-hmm. and she loves being there, and you know, and it just feels very warm and cozy and inviting, and like it totally makes sense that Wednesday and Pugsley would go to camp and collect all of the like various, you know, sort of miscreants at the camp yeah. and become friends and a team with them, because like that's what their family does. That's what it means to be an Adams.
Yeah, to collect the miscreants.
Yeah.
We should all be collecting miscreants, I think. That's the takeaway.
And then we should be hanging out with them in person.
In person!
We're in person, you guys! For those who missed us at the beginning, we are in person together for the first time since the podcast started.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
It's very exciting. Like, the last time we saw each other was February of 2020. And yeah. it is today, November 6th, 2021.
Ah!
In that time, we have recorded over 75 episodes of this podcast.
That's so many.
It's so many. if you're not necessarily like a from the beginning listener to the show, you may not remember that we used to put out 2 episodes a week during the first parts of the pandemic.
That was a terrible idea. Why did we think we could sustain that?
Because we had nothing better
nothing
to
else
do.
Going on because it was the pandemic.
Yeah, like I was in my last semester of grad school, not working on my dissertation yet, and
I was dealing with all of the arts having just closed.
Mm-hmm. So
yeah, but we're still going.
We are. We're still here. And we're so glad that you've all stuck with us. And I'm glad that we can be here together in person now for the first time.
And because this is the unedited live version, instead of putting in our fun little music here, we're going to do what we actually do when we record, which is go, okay, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Hey, so this is the time in every show where we take a break to thank our patrons on Patreon, and especially our romantic lead, to include Melissa Englander. Yay! Hey!
I got her.
Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey, mwah, 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 we love you. Thank you so much for continuing to support the show. I have nothing pithy to say because I defended my dissertation yesterday and my brain is made of goo. So
we've got a doctor here who needs to have things to do with her doctorate. If you want to help us continue to do things with that, you can become a patron on patreon.com/romcomkilljoys. And sometimes we put up fun stuff back there. Sometimes we let you vote on movies or hear the bits that we do cut out when we edit these.
Yeah.
So go check it out. And obviously, if you're watching us on Instagram, you already follow us on Instagram, but follow us on Instagram and Facebook and our YouTube, which we have put like 3 whole things on.
Including this.
Including this now, which is exciting. And we'll have more content coming this month. We are going to be doing movies that aren't really rom-coms, but maybe they're rom-coms. So stay tuned to see what else we cover while we go through the month.
I have a really good one, and I haven't told Eliza about it yet, and I can't wait to. I'm
going
to tell
her
after we get done.
We haven't finalized everything yet, so we're working on it. Anyways, that's that.
All right, so now we get to the, now we do the do-do-do-do-do-do music here. Okay, so Eliza, it seems like this is a hit. I mean, we both love this movie. My brain is, again, jello. So we need supplements.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to ask you to go first.
That's fine.
What
that's
is
fine.
Your supplement for Adam's Family Values?
I mean, I love this movie so much because I love dark humor. I love macabre humor. Literally as I said that, I came up with another supplement that hadn't been in my head until this moment.
Please.
So that's great. Yes. I'm gonna start with that one. Read the play, The Marriage of Bette and Boo.
Amazing supplement.
Chris Durang. It is a very weird play, very dark humor. Very similar to Adamsy kind of humor in a lot of ways. go read that play. It's excellent. What I was going to say was, during October, I was in the mood for some Halloween-y type things, and I started watching the TV show What We Do in the Shadows.
Oh, yay!
Which I had not watched before, and is so great, and I feel like has a very Addams Family Values kind of humor, in that like a lot of very weird or very dark things are just said straight to camera as if they're totally normal. And it's that kind of like, I don't know, that just kind of like weird humor where it kind of takes you a second, like, did they really just say that?
Right.
But yeah, it's essentially like a documentary, sort of, you know, The Office style, but about a group of vampires who all live together. And it sort of supposes the question, like, what if living forever just makes you real dumb? And so, like, they're vampires and they're all powerful, but they're also idiots. And it's hilarious and it's very funny. And it's Taika Waititi is one of the creators and it's phenomenal. There's also a movie, which he is in, that he and his buddies made before they made the TV show. Very funny, very silly, good spooky vibes. Yeah.
I love all of those. Thank you. I love What We Do in the Shadows. I actually saw that in theaters, the movie, when it came out. I knew nothing about it. Mm-hmm. The only thing I knew about it was that Jemaine Clement was in it, mm-hmm. and I love Flight of the Conchords.
Right.
So I was like, okay, I'm going to go see this movie. Blew me away. I didn't know what I was expecting, but it was not that.
It's weird.
So like for the first time Taika Waititi bites into someone's neck and the blood starts spurting out, I was screaming. I was rolling in the aisles at the one of the independent cinemas in DC, E Street?
Maybe.
E Street. No.
Oh, E Street Cinema. Yeah.
E Street Cinema. Yeah.
Where Rocky Horror used to be.
Where Rocky Horror used to be.
Yes.
Tech Support has it. No, but my actual recommendation, which I don't think I've ever actually made this supplement on the show before, which is kind of startling. But since my brain is broken, I'm just going to go to one of my favorite things to recommend ever. And also, it's sort of New York related, coming out of the New York Neo-Futurists, one of my favorite theater companies. I want to recommend the long-running podcast Welcome to Night Vale. I feel like it has very strong Addams Family vibes, in the sense that it's sort of about our world, but not our world, a parallel world where things are just very weird, but people are sort of like incredibly lovely to each other in that world and accept weirdness as a fact. Mm-hmm. And it also kind of allows for, because of that weirdness, it allows for this kind of like kindness for difference. Like there's a character in Welcome to Night Vale who's just like a disembodied hand, but she's also like a little girl, but she's also a disembodied adult man's hand,
obviously,
and people like love her and want to take care of her. And it's that sort of like ethos that I think is very Addams Family Values-y, and it captures that feeling for me that it's like, yeah, you know, like, you know, sometimes things are weird and they're not what you expect,
right.
But like just be joyful and delighted by them and embrace people for who they are and what they are.
I feel like there's a real like millennial Gen Z kind of humor there that has become mm-hmm. much more common in the 21st century, but mm-hmm. that like exists in Addams Family Values.
True. It's very prescient in that way.
Right. That kind of like weird internet humor. That's the sort of like, the things don't actually have to make any sense. Like you can just pick a meme picture and something that sounds like a meme phrase and put it together and be like, yeah, this is funny. And there's going to be an adult somewhere who's like, I don't understand. Okay, what's the purpose? And you're like, there is no purpose. It's just funny. I feel like the starts of that kind of modern surrealist humor are in Addams Family Values.
That's a really profound thesis to be throwing out when we're in the supplement phase of the conversation, but I really love it, actually.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole new episode about this where we just start there and go forward.
Hypothesis. The Addams Family is the origin of Gen Z humor.
If there are any Gen Z people listening, let us know what you think of that. And go watch Addams Family Values because you probably haven't.
Because we're old now.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, we're in our 30s.
That's weird.
Yeah, I mean, one of us is a doctor.
What? They allowed me to be a doctor. Did you
know? And on that note, I'm going to raise my glass to the new Dr. Walker. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you all for tuning in. This was super fun. So great to get to do this live and get to do this in person.
Yes, I'm so glad to be here in your apartment for the first time ever.
Tune in next week.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com, not us,
not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, it starts and kissing and making up.